I'd now like to introduce a true leader in the business aviation community here in Atlanta, state of Georgia, and really throughout the United States. Jimmy W. Hayes is the President and Chief Operating Officer of Cox Enterprises. All of you know that Cox is a leader in the media and in auto trading services. Jimmy has been with Cox for a number of years in a number of different capacities, including that of Chief Financial Officer. So when it comes time to decide the true value of a thing like a business aircraft, Jimmy's one that truly knows. And he's tremendously supportive of business aviation, not only through his professional association and through Cox Enterprises, but also because he is an avid pilot and aviator. So, ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Jimmy W.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's really an honor to be here to have a chance to talk to you about Cox Enterprises, about Cox Enterprises Flight Operations Department. And it's nice to follow Governor Perdue because he's a great guy, he's a great governor, and also a fellow aviation enthusiast. So I'm really happy about that. Well, it was a typical hot, hazy summer day in Atlanta on July 26, 1976. But it was that day that began for me what has been a lifelong passion. For it was on that day that I drove down to South Fulton Airport, 8 Alpha 9, for those of you that still navigate around the Atlanta airspace. It was that day that I decided to walk up to the counter to inquire about learning to fly. You see, I'd grown up about 3 miles from that airport, and I'd always driven by and seen the small airplanes going in and out. And you know, at that point in time, I had been in 2 airplanes in my life, both commercial airplanes, and had never been in a small airplane. Well, South Fulton was a typical small-town airport. It could have been anywhere in the South. It could have been anywhere in the country, for that matter. South Fulton had a few shade hangars outside that protected a few aircraft from the hot, weathering sun. South Fulton had a dirty, oily maintenance hangar where some work got done on the airplanes. There were a number of airplanes tied down in the hot, hazy sun of Atlanta weathering away. And South Fulton had a couple of relatively new Cessna 150s that were used for instruction. South Fulton was managed by a guy by the name of Hoppy Hopkins, and Hoppy was a real character. You know, a lot of the airports in those days were managed by guys like Hoppy, and they were really a unique breed of people. There were guys like Joe or Sarge or Mac or Hoppy, and they were really the guys that kept the airports alive. They managed to keep the airplanes in the air most of the time. They managed to keep the bills paid at least some of the time. They managed to provide a fresh pot of hot coffee for the pilots occasionally. And they had story after story after story of BS, really, all of the time. But they were an important part of the aviation fabric that has been woven since man's first flight. Well, within an hour of walking up to that counter, I'd been buckled in to the left seat of a little November 66169, a 1974 Cessna 150. I had a briefing, sort of. And I was ready for my first lesson that would include climbs and glides and turns and a stall demo and a flap demo. And I have to tell you, from the moment we first started down the runway and pressure started building up underneath the wings of this little red and white Cessna generating lift, I was hooked. Now, you don't know me, most of you do not, but I'm compulsive. And I was hooked, and I knew at that moment that I was going to get my pilot's license. Well, the following Sunday, with 7 hours of instruction and 26 takeoff and landings, I returned for my solo. And I know you all remember, just as I do, the day of my solo. I remember it like it was yesterday. Now, I was a much younger guy, and I had longer hair, and it wasn't gray, what hair I had. But I remember it just like it was yesterday, and it was a very, very special day for me. Well, it was 16 days after that before I could return to the cockpit. Travel requirements of my new job, I was freshly out of graduate school, and I was in my first 12 months of gainful full-time employment. But when I did return, I returned with that compulsion I spoke of earlier. I returned fully committed, and 33 days later, with a total of 48.6 hours in my logbook, I received my private pilot's license, my ticket for travel, exploration, freedom, technology, and the elusive $100 hamburger. You know, they really did exist in those days. They certainly do not today, but there's some details in aviation we just shouldn't tie down. A month later, I purchased my first airplane. It was a 1961 175, a straight-tail Cessna with a geared prop, 1,200 hours total time, airframe and engine, a radio that worked most of the time, an ADF that was really worked all the time. It was great for tuning WSB-AM as I was flying around in the South in those days. It had a transponder that worked every now and then. But that was my airplane, purchased for $8,000, still flying today, registered to an owner out in Nebraska, and worth certainly a lot more than $8,000. And like many of you in the room, that's one of the airplanes that I should never have sold. 31 years later, I still have the same passion for aviation today that I had in 1976. Millions of hours and thousands of dollars later, well, I guess I really mean thousands of hours and more dollars than I care to count later, I still rely on aviation for travel, for exploration, visiting our children away at college in Colorado, freedom, technology, and yes, that elusive $100 hamburger. Today, I personally fly between 250 and 300 hours a year, and I see all that is good in aviation across America. And while aviation provides all of these opportunities for all of us and more, it provides so much more, and that's why we're here this week. Now, I didn't share my aviation story with you this morning because it's unique or different. In fact, I suspect it sounded pretty familiar to many or maybe most of you in the room today. I shared it with you so that you would understand as I deliver my remaining brief comments this morning, you would know that they're coming from someone that's just as passionate about aviation as each and every one of you here today. Well, when I purchased my Cessna 175 back in 1976, I moved to Fulton County Airport, Charlie Brown, as it was known in those days. I felt that my pilot's license was the beginning, and from that I would gain additional experiences and additional ratings and additional capabilities. So I wanted to move to an airport that had a control tower. Charlie Brown had a control tower, and it had a number of general aviation aircraft on the field in those days. I remember lots of occasions when I would be, in the air, headed toward the airport, and I would hear the tower say, 8279 Tango, keep your speed up, Gulfstream number 2 behind you. Or 8279 Tango, clear to take off runway 8, caution wake turbulence from the Gulfstream departing ahead of you. I remember thinking, pretty cool. I'm out here flying my $8,000 Cessna, with a transponder repaired by then, hopefully, around with the big guys like the Gulfstreams. Well, little did I know that I would be hired by Cox just a few years later, and that in all likelihood, Cox was the company operating that Gulfstream in and out and around Charlie Brown that I would see and hear so often. In those days, Cox Enterprises operated one aircraft, and in 1976, it was a Gulfstream II, November 1040. But Cox's aviation history goes very deep. Briefly, for those of you not familiar with Cox, we operate 6 divisions around the country, including newspapers, television stations, radio stations, a wholesale automobile auction business branded Mannheim, cable television properties, and a number of other businesses like Autotrader.com, Valpak, Kudzu, and the Travel Channel. We reach about 100 million people across the country with our products and services. Our company was founded in 1898 when James M. Cox purchased the Dayton Daily newspaper in Dayton, Ohio for $26,000. Our founder became the governor of Ohio for a number of terms and in 1920 ran for president of the United States. And he ran for president with Franklin Delano Roosevelt before Campobello and Polio, obviously, in 1920, and they lost that election to Warren Harding, another newspaper man from Ohio. Well, I have to tell you, after that, Governor Cox never returned to politics, and I'm one of some 80,000 employees around the country that are particularly glad that he chose, instead of returning to politics, to build a media and telecommunications company that we're all very proud to call home. In 1934, Governor Cox entered broadcasting by putting WHIO-AM on the air in Dayton, Ohio. And in 1936, this first Air Scout took to the air. This open cockpit biplane would circle the city, and our reporter would look atop the old Dayton Hotel, the Miami Hotel, rather, for a waving blanket as signals for on-the-air and off-the-air reports to begin and end. And certainly we've come a long way since then. Today we have helicopters and planes circling around cities delivering traffic reports, following a chase scene, or delivering other late-breaking news for our audiences. And by the way, the Dayton International Airport in Ohio is named for Governor Cox today. But aviation has done so much more to enable our company to grow over the years. We began our corporate flight operations department in 1940 with the purchase of a Twin Beach. But I suppose our company's first plane was the Beach Staggerwing, November 1030, which we owned and operated for about 6 months in 1940, during which time we put about 172 hours on this plane. When we sold this stagger wing, November 1030, the owner, the purchaser, wanted to keep the end number. So we applied for and received November 1040, which is the end number that was on this Twin Beach, and it's also the number that we still operate with today for our principal aircraft. Our pilots, I've been in the jump seat, and the number of times I've heard controllers say, 1040, are you guys with the IRS? Pilots get a chuckle, and they answer, surely that's not the case. Now, the issues in corporate aviation in the early days were very similar to some of the issues today, and in a lot of ways, they were very different. I was traveling through a box of old documents that we had in the flight department recently, and I ran across just a few interesting examples. In the early summer of 1940, we were looking for just the right solution for aviation safety concerns. We needed parachutes, something every airplane should have, at least in the 1940s. Need a good parachute? Give Joe Crane a call at Roosevelt Field on Long Island. I'm not sure if Joe is still around, but I'm sure that the price of parachutes have gone up quite a bit. And by the way, Roosevelt Field was named for Theodore Roosevelt's son, Quentin, who was killed in air combat in World War I. Roosevelt Field was a civilian airport, a military airport, and went back and forth. It was really at its peak in the 1930s and was America's busiest civilian airfield, but was closed in 1951. During the cold winter months of 1941, we were looking for a connection to help us get new feathering props for the Twin Beach. This is the letter that we wrote trying to get approval for just that. But you know, you have to be careful what you ask for. The good news is we got the props. The bad news is just a few months later, the government decided they needed our plane as our country was preparing for escalating conflicts abroad. We had flown that airplane about 349 hours when we turned it over. Well, things are certainly different today, but not all things. I ran across a letter from one of our passengers to the chief pilot stating that their flight from Miami to Dayton was really delightful. The air was smooth, the sky was clear, but the chicken was a bit tough. That letter was written in 1946, but I suppose it could just as well have been written last week. The more things change, the more they stay the same. From 1940 until 1986, when Cox's flight operations began reporting to me, we transitioned through a number of aircraft. Following World War II, Cox was ready to return to the skies, and we purchased this Lockheed Lodestar, which we operated for about 10 years and put 4,486 hours on it. Following this Lodestar, we purchased a Lockheed Learstar in 1955 and operated until 1961 when we made our first visit down to Savannah, I suppose, and purchased our first Gulfstream, a Gulfstream 1, which is the twin-engine turboprop. Then in 1969, Cox was ready to enter the jet ages. We moved down to Gulfstream, Savannah, and purchased our G2, which is probably the same one that was on my 6 when I was flying in and out of Charlie Brown back in the late 70s. Prior to 1986, Cox operated only one aircraft, and most of the flights were for a small number of executives and a few principal family members. In fact, when Cox's flight operations began reporting to me in 1986, at that point we were operating a Gulfstream 3, and we had a staff of 5 people consisting of 3 pilots and 2 mechanics. That was because prior to 1985, Cox really operated in 2 separate companies. Cox Communications was a public company, and that's where we operated the cable television, the radio, the television, and the automobile auction properties. Cox Enterprises was a private company, and they operated the newspapers, and that's where ownership of the aircraft rested. So Cox Communications had limited access to the company plane prior to 1985, when we took Cox Communications private through a merger and merged the 2 companies. That's when we began using our corporate flight operations in a much broader way. Slowly increasing access to the aircraft, we began having opportunities to use our aircraft as a competitive differentiator. Our company was definitely in growth mode in those days, and using our one airplane allowed Cox to scramble in short notice to negotiate acquisition agreements or complete due diligence associated with the timely closing of one of many acquisitions we were working on. And along the way, our operating teams began having access to the aircraft, which allowed them to visit more of their businesses in a shorter period of time and on a more frequent basis. And yes, we could have visited those same locations commercially and did in fact then and still do as we spend tens of millions of dollars each year for commercial air travel. But at Cox, we view our employees as our most important and most valuable resource. And we place family values and work-life balance very high on those list of things that we consider important. We can use our flight operations department to not only allow our management teams to cover lots of properties in a short period of time, but also be able to return home that evening to be with their families for dinner or to catch a baseball game or a soccer match or a dance recital, or whatever happens to be going on in their family lives. To borrow the context of a prominent commercial I'm sure you've seen, you might think of it this way to describe a typical day in a Cox traveling executive's life. 8:30 a.m., breakfast with the general manager in Hampton Roads, $22. 12:30, lunch with a customer service team in Rhode Island, $150. Aviation chargeback for the Virginia Rhode Island day trip, $6,000. Being back home in time for the daughter's soccer match, priceless. As usage expanded and technology changed, we upgraded our fleet to two Gulfstream G4s, and today we also have added mid-range Hawkers as well. In fact, today we operate two Gulfstream 5s, and in December we'll add our third Hawker to the fleet. We fly around 2,500 hours per year, and our flight department has grown to about 40 people, including pilots and mechanics and dispatchers and flight attendants. I view our flight department as a critical part of our company's success. I view our flight department as an enabler. For example, just a few years ago, we were switching out the provisioning service for Cox's high-speed internet product in our cable division. With time of the essence and millions of customers dependent upon Cox for their high-speed internet service, and with operating locations scattered all around the country, on and off of the commercial air travel schedules, we found ourselves in a very challenging situation where we had to get file service to a number of locations over the next 12 to 18 hours. It was a Saturday evening when I got the call requesting whether or not our flight operations could help with this challenge. Well, we quickly assembled our flight crews together that December evening, and during the overnight hours, we delivered engineers and file servers around the country to keep our high-speed internet product up and running. Our corporate flight operations department had once again proven invaluable. In fact, just a few years ago, following Katrina, we also saw firsthand the importance of our flight operations capability. We operate the cable television system in New Orleans, and we also operate an automobile auction market in New Orleans. Immediately following Katrina, we were able to move critical supplies from diapers and water and other essential items into Louisiana for our employees and their families. And they were, obviously, as you all know, facing a lot of dire challenges. In fact, we were able to overfly that market at 3,000 feet just a few days after the hurricane so that our engineers could better assess the damage and really evaluate their plans to get our operations back up and going in that market. And today, I'm convinced more than ever that we operate in a number of smaller cities that we would not be in if general aviation airports did not exist in those cities, and if we did not have the flight operations resources to support our transportation needs to those cities. Of course, we would get there, but at what price? Certainly, it would be the time of our management teams, what we believe to be a very valuable commodity. And, of course, I'm a big fan of commercial aviation. I believe the most beautiful aircraft ever built was a 747. And the 757 of today is sleek and beautiful. It just leaves a little too much wake turbulence to suit me. Our company could not perform without commercial air travel. As I've already mentioned, we spend tens of millions of dollars each year for travel. But my point is that commercial aviation and general aviation, including business and private aircraft, must continue to coexist, and we must share airspace, airports, taxiways, controllers, and yes, even passengers. Now, I'm not a lobbyist, and I don't intend to be one this morning. However, the banter back and forth on user fees is really unfortunate. When I read a story about two commercial aircraft that tragically nearly collide in Florida, and the story goes on to attribute the near disaster on an overly worked air traffic system that is stressed because, allegedly, of the growth in general aviation, I become very disillusioned, for that really is not the issue. When I read press releases, stories, and editorials that misinterpret the impact of general aviation on the air traffic system, I become very disillusioned, for that is really not the issue. The fact is, business and corporate turbine aircraft and general aviation is essentially unchanged over the last 6 years, remaining at about 3.1 million hours per year since 1999. And in fact, a significant percentage of those hours are flown in connection with flights in and out of outside of the commercially crowded Class B airport facilities. In fact, business operations account for only 3.5% of total traffic at our nation's 20 busiest air hubs. During that same time, commercial aviation has grown significantly as airlines have chosen to populate routes with additional, smaller, more fuel-efficient aircraft by replacing larger jets or many routes with regional jets. According to a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, Airlines grounded a net of 385 airplanes, large airplanes, I should say, from 2000 through 2006, but during that same period of time added 1,029 regional jets. That's not bad, by the way. I like the idea of more fuel-efficient travel, and if the travel needs of the American public warrant such changes, then I'm fully in support of them. Our company pays hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes each year, and some of those tax dollars were used to provide financial support and relief to our nation's airlines. I'm absolutely okay with that. Our nation's airlines are a vital part of our country's economy. What I am against is the continued irrational rhetoric around how our nation's air traffic system upgrade should be funded. Certainly, we can all agree that upgrading our air traffic system is something we should do. And certainly, we should all agree that that's something the cost of which should be borne by all. Commercial aviation, general aviation, passengers should all bear in the burden of the upgrade cost. And our taxes should also provide part of the funding of the upgrade. After all, a safe, state-of-the-art traffic system is vitally important to a strong economy. Unfortunately, that's where the camaraderie breaks down. I'm sad to report we're not all likely to participate in the funding of cost to upgrade our air traffic system. House Bill 2881 proposes such incremental funding be borne largely by general aviation, and the concept of this, I suppose, is that general aviation is the incremental user, and historically commercial aviation has paid a larger than its fair share of cost for our nation's air traffic system. That's the theory. I'm not sure that holds true. But I suppose, just as Ed has said this morning, in the context of our country's moving forward with respect to upgrading our air traffic control system, general aviation can and should step up to the plate to support such a plan. Now, the good news is, just last week, the House Ways and Means Committee approved a proposal along the lines of House Bill 2881, and the bill, in fact, was passed by the House. While it does provide for material increases in fuel taxes, I believe 38% for Jet A and 25% for 100 low lead, the proposed legislation is appropriately focused on funding the necessary upgrades for our air traffic control system, and it does not introduce unnecessary bureaucratic inefficiencies that the alternatively proposed user fee structure would result in. Now, the really sad news is that the airline industry does not support this legislation, because it doesn't provide enough of a shifting of cost between commercial aviation and general aviation. At least that's the implication of the ATA's press releases that I read last week. And Senators Rockefeller and Lott are also driving proposals in the Senate that would be very harmful for general aviation, and that's really unfortunate. Very simply put, our company has paid a lot of tax dollars to help bail out the airline industry, and I'm okay with that. Our company is willing to participate with the general aviation industry in absorbing the majority of the incremental funding for an upgrade to our air traffic control system, and I'm okay with that, both corporately and as a personal pilot. But I'm not okay with legislation that is more focused on shifting the payment of dollars than it is focused on providing the incremental funding for the upgrades to our air traffic control system, particularly when the real increases in air traffic are coming not from general aviation but from commercial aviation instead. Therefore, I really urge each of you to become involved with the grassroots efforts and make sure that you communicate with your congressmen and your senators and you let them know that you're in support of House Bill 2881, which is a rational approach to addressing our nation's air traffic control needs. Let's be smart and fund the upgrades to our air traffic control systems with much more efficient fuel taxes, and let's avoid unnecessary, inefficient user fees. And for goodness sake, let's not put even more stress on restrictions on our nation's airspace. Americans enjoy an incredible freedom to safely navigate our nation's airspace without excessive fees, and this right should not be taken for granted, and it shouldn't be removed by aggressive lobbying efforts in Washington. Now, before I conclude this morning, I have to point out yet another wonderful application for my passion of general aviation. Around the country, each and every day, patients and family members are flown free of charge to airports, large and small, for medical treatment. Many organizations, such as Angel Flight of Georgia, provide the critical life linkage between patients and their medical treatment. And general aviation pilots donate their time, their airplanes, and the fuel for the missions for this wonderful cause. Let's not destroy the aviation fiber of our country by burdening these pilots with unnecessary fees or even more airspace restrictions. I've flown into too many airports where the FBO would waive the handling fee because of the nature of this flight, only to find that the airport authority didn't waive their fee. That's why user fees are such a slippery slope. I've flown almost 24 Angel Flight missions over the last 2 years, and I can tell you that I consider my Angel Flights to be one of the most important things that I do personally to give back to our communities. And I encourage each of you to get involved with your local Angel Flight organizations or Mercy Flight organization as well. Very simply put, we as Americans have a wonderful opportunity to enjoy the wonderful freedoms, one of the most wonderful freedoms of all mankind through aviation. Our country's Bill of Rights provides a number of freedoms we all hold dear. But the freedom to ascend into the clouds or fly into a beautiful setting sun is one that none of us should take for granted. And this freedom has been and continues to be protected by our many men and women that serve in our country's military, both in the past and today, even as we stand here and sit here in this meeting room this morning. Let's not jeopardize this wonderful freedom. Let's not destroy our passion. Let's work together to build and develop our country's aviation future. I hope you have a great convention. I hope you have a great time in the terrific city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia. And as Sonny said this morning, welcome, y'all.